Let's return again to Judges 13. We'll read verses 17 and 18. And Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, What is thy name, that when thy sayings come to pass, we may do thee honor? And the angel of the Lord said unto him, Why askest thou thus after my name, seeing it is secret? And if you have a Bible with some marginal notes, you'll note that there's one beside that word secret in some Bibles, and the little footnote or reference note says, or wonderful. So this is a word that can be translated either secret or wonderful. Well, this was no ordinary time. You can read in verse 1, The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. This wasn't just an election cycle. This wasn't just a presidential term. This was 40 years of oppression from enemies, the worst enemies, the Philistines. No ordinary time. This was no ordinary couple. We read in verse 2 about Manoah and his wife that she was barren and bare not, which was a terrible curse in these days and a tremendous problem in their eyes. And this was no ordinary visitor that they had. In verse 3, we read, The angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman. And in fact, it wasn't just no ordinary visitor, as we'll see, it was no ordinary angel. We want to look at this encounter between Manoah and his wife and the angel of the Lord. First of all, we want to notice the wonderful person here. Then his wonderful name. Thirdly, his wonderful act. And fourthly, a wonderful fellowship. But first of all, here we have a wonderful person revealed to us in this chapter. He's wonderful because on the one hand, he is described as man. You'll notice that, for example, in verse 6, the woman, that's Manoah's wife, came and told her husband, saying, A man of God came to me. Then in verse 8, Manoah entreats the Lord and says, O Lord, let the man of God come again to us. In verse 10, we read, Behold, the man has appeared unto me. And again in verse 11, Manoah asks this visitor, Art thou the man? So, very clearly, in their view, at least in the early part of this chapter, we have someone who at least appears to be a man. But on the other hand, he's also God. He's also God. We notice that at the very end of this chapter. In verse 22, Manoah says to his wife, We shall surely die because we have seen God. So you've got a remarkable combination here, man and God. How does this work? How can this be? Is one of them wrong? Is it a man or God? No, it seems to be man and God, God and man. How do we figure this out? Well, I think first of all, we have to note the title of this visitor was the angel of the Lord. And angel simply means messenger, messenger, someone who carries a message. It's not so much a reference to a particular substance, as if it's about angelic substance or angelic nature. It's more about functionality. What is the purpose of this visitor? It is to bring messages from the Lord. That's what angels often did. And this character, this visitor, appears in various parts of the Old Testament. especially the early parts. He appears to Abraham, appears to Jacob, he appears to Moses, he appears to Joshua, he appears to Gideon, and here again he appears, this time to Samson's parents. And each time he comes, he brings messages from the Lord, and each time he comes, it usually starts with, everyone thinks he's a man, but by the end of the encounter, there's a sense, we've just met with God. It was indeed no mere man, because not only this passage, but if we bring together the teaching from these other passages, including, say, the encounter with Hagar in Genesis 16, we find that this messenger of the Lord spoke as God. He spoke with divine authority. He also displays divine attributes. He also does divine acts. He also has a distinct divine identity. He will often speak of the Lord and God, and yet other times he speaks as God. He speaks of God, he speaks as God. At times he identifies himself with the Lord, with Jehovah. Other times he distinguishes himself as if he is God, and yet he is a person within the Godhead. Who can this be? Well, I hope as these facts begin to merge in your mind that you're thinking, this seems like Jesus. This seems like the second person of the Godhead, he who was the eternal Word and who came with messages to his people in the New Testament. He who, like this person, had divine attributes, spoke as God and spoke of God, who did divine acts, who received divine worship and accepted it. Is this the same person? And if so, how come? I thought Jesus didn't come in the flesh until Bethlehem. You're right, he did not come in the flesh. He did not come as a true man until Bethlehem, but he came in the form of flesh. He came in the form of a man before that, repeatedly, in the Old Testament, this being one of these instances. He was, you might say, impersonating man, taking on the form of humanity for a short time in order to visit his needy people and bring to them messages of grace. That's why we say here we have the most wonderful person. We have here really almost as if it's the Son's holy impatience to be with his people being demonstrated. He knows that in time, in the fullness of time, he will come in real human flesh. But in the meantime, when he sees his people in such need, at such a time, with such a problem, he cannot wait, as it were, and comes in the form of humanity to minister to them. It's his holy impatience, his holy enthusiasm breaking forth, his desire to be with and dwell with and speak with his precious people. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. The same heart that beat in him here, beat in him on earth, and beats in him to this day, metaphorically speaking. This is a wonderful person we're talking about here, the Son of God, the second person of the Godhead, the pre-incarnate Christ. What a visitor. And if he was a wonderful person then, when it was just the form of flesh, how much more wonderful now, when it's real flesh. the same real flesh he took on him when he was here on earth, in glorified form, is now his forever. That's how much he loves humanity or humanness. He didn't just take it for a time and then dispense with it, glad to be rid of it. No, he took it and he kept it, never separated from it. His divine nature always united with his body and his soul through life, through death, and through all eternity. What a wonderful person. But we have here, secondly, a wonderful name. A wonderful name. Let's look at this incident. There's been a bit of to and froing, and then the angel comes back, the messenger comes back, and Manoah is brought by his wife to meet with this angel. And in verse 15, Manoah has a proposal. Manoah says, "Lord, let us detain you until we shall have made ready a kid for thee." Now, here Manoah is basically saying, stay for dinner, stay for a meal. And in these days especially, to have a meal was to have communion, it was to have fellowship. That was what Manoah was wanting. It wasn't just let's have a bite to eat together, it was let's talk. We want to hear what you have to say. We'd like to share our lives with you as well. That's what happened over meals. And so here, he's got this proposal, let's have dinner, let's have lunch together. But the angel says no. The angel replies, though thou detain me, okay, I'll stay, but I won't eat of your bread. And if we're talking about food, he's saying, if thou wilt offer a burnt offering, and thou must offer it unto the Lord. What's this angel, what's the Son of God doing here for Manoah and his wife? He's teaching them in a very simple, step-by-step fashion. And here's one of the things he's teaching them. He's saying, you want communion, you want fellowship, you want conversation, you want us to share life together? You've missed step one. Before there can be any communion or fellowship or sharing or friendship, there has to be sacrifice. There has to be atonement. He's teaching them that he's no ordinary person. He's no mere man. He's beginning to reveal his non-ordinariness, his wonderfulness to them. And he's pointing them to the need for sacrifice. He's pointing them for the need to sacrifice to the Lord. And hold that thought in your mind, because as we'll see, he's about to reveal that he is the Lord of sacrifice. We're told here at the end of verse 16, Manoah knew not that he was an angel of the Lord. It's sort of excusing his ignorance, as it were. It's saying at this point in time, he wasn't fully aware of the identity of this divine person in front of him. Otherwise, he would have got this right. He would never have thought, oh, let's be friends, without first, let's have fire for sacrifice. As it were, an excuse for Manoah, but there's no excuse for us, is there? We know better. We know better. There can be no fellowship without fire, no sharing without sacrifice, no approaching to God without atonement. And it's already been made, hasn't it? By the Lord Jesus himself. So, let's never imagine that we can approach this holy, wonderful person without the shedding of blood, without the giving away of life in sacrifice. And then there's an interesting development here when the angel says, let's not eat, let's do this instead, let's have sacrifice. It's as if Manoah begins to realize this is not an ordinary person. There's something unusual about this person. Because we read in verse 17, Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "What is thy name, that when thy sayings may come to pass, we may do thee honor?" What is thy name? That wasn't like we ask somebody, "Well, what's your name?" And you just get, you know, Joe or Linda or whatever. It's just a term of identification that separates us from others. Name in the Old Testament especially was about character. It was very much about essential identity. That's why so much emphasis is placed on changes of names of people like Abram, Sarai, and so on, Jacob to Israel, because names reflected character and names revealed character. And therefore, when Manoah is saying, "What's your name?" He's not just, you know, asking something for his address, because where he's it's a theological question. It's a very deep and penetrating question. He's saying, "Okay, I want to get behind what I'm seeing. I want to go deeper. I want to find out who you really are and what you're really about. Tell me your name." In other words, the sense of no mere man is growing in him. And then it's interesting, the angel's response. The angel of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask after my name, seeing it is secret?" Why do you ask after my name, seeing it's secret? Notice this is in response to Manoah not just saying, "What's your name?" but "What's your name that we may do you honor when your sayings come to pass?" And you see here the beautiful instinct of a believer here. Because Manoah's basically saying, "What's your name? Give me some knowledge that I may do, that I may serve." And he's recognizing the more I can know about you, the better I can honor you. The more I get into your real essential identity, the more valuable and honorable will my service be of you. Again, this is such an important order in the Christian life, isn't it? Maybe especially when we're young believers, we want to be doing, we want to be acting, we want to be serving. But Manoah here recognizes, I need to know more. I'm in a state of ignorance here, and I realize that in ignorance, lacking in knowledge, there's a danger that I'm going to do something wrong, that I may not honor God or may not honor this person aright. And so he says, "Give me some knowledge that I may serve you better." That's why we emphasize theology, isn't it? That's why we come to learn about the Bible, isn't it? There's always a danger in the church of just ending up with so-called practical Christianity. And practical Christianity is good, but not in the absence of theological Christianity. There was a time in the end of the 1600s in England. It was a time when Matthew Henry was alive and writing. And there was a big movement in the church of these days to get to a more moral or practical Christianity. They looked back on the era of all the wars of religion. They looked at the fights between the Roman Catholics and the Protestants, the fights within Protestantism. And they saw this is really just all about theology? Why can't we have a religion that's just practical and moral and ethical and reasonable? And we can work this out. And so they did. And so the church died. And that's what will happen. If we have no taste or desire for knowledge, for theology, for learning, then our Christian faith, our Christian life, our Christian churches will die. So here, though a primitive believer, Manoah gets it. Give me some knowledge that I may do, that I may worship, that I may serve, that I may honor. And the code of this too for him is this name. He senses that this name is very special, and therefore the angel replies, confirming that. He's saying, why do you ask after my name, seeing it is secret? Now, this can mean two things. A secret can mean simply that. It's hidden, it's concealed. And it was. Because, as we said, this was before his incarnation. This was before the full revelation of the Son of God in human flesh. This was too early to let everything out. Much still had to be taught the Old Testament church, bit by bit, piece by piece, line upon line, precept upon precept, until the fullness of time when God could send forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law. And so there's a concealment, there's a hiddenness, there's a holding back that has been communicated to Manoah. He's saying to him, really, it's a good question, but it's not the right time. This is a good motivation, but it wouldn't be safe for you or for others to know everything right now. It's secret. And in a sense, in talking about the secrecy and the concealment and the hiddenness, there's also a revealing going on. He's revealing that it's hidden for now, but hinting that more is to come, that fuller revelation will come down the road. And again, you compare ourselves with these Old Testament believers in their time of shadows and darkness and hiddenness and secrecy and just the ABCs of believing with us, with the fullness and the brightness and the midday sun of revelation and all that we know. We know so much more about this wonderful name and this wonderful person. No longer can it really be said it is secret. Now it's open, it's public, it's full, it's free, it's available, inviting us to know all the more in order that we may honor all the more and serve all the more and do all the more. This surely is the same question we want to ask today and find answered in even fuller fashion today. He's saying, ask after my name, because it's knowable now. It's available now. It's accessible now. My whole character has been revealed in the incarnation and the person and work of Christ. And as we know more, surely we should honor more. We should lift up this name more, worship this name better. It's a secret name, but as we said, it can also be translated wonderful. Wonderful. Full of wonder. Awesome. It's astonishing. It's amazing. It's astounding. It's dazzling. It's overwhelming. And in this, he's saying to Manoah, you can't bear this right now. It's too big, it's too great, it's too awesome, it's too astonishing. It would blow your mind and your heart and your being apart. It's wonderful. It should create a sense of wonder and awe and amazement. How much more for us? How precious are these names? We do talk about the third commandment most often in a negative sense, how not to dishonor the Lord's name, and that's right. God forbid that we fall into any of these sins that were outlined in these catechisms. But there is that positive side as well, that we should be seeking more and more to lift up and honor and revere and fear the name of the Lord, especially as we know more about the name and we know more of his names, multiple names. How much more we have, therefore how much more reverence should we have? The effect of this should be wonder. And if there's no wonder, there's no knowledge. If there's knowledge, there should be wonder. One thing we've started doing a little bit in family worship after we sing a psalm at the beginning is I usually wait till all the children have closed their psalters, and then I ask them, what did you just sing about? And if you were to ask myself, I'd probably at times be as unable to answer as they are. We can love the songs, the tunes, the melodies, and get into such a habit, and we're taking God's name on our lips, and yet we're not thinking about it. I wonder if we did that exercise here. After a psalter, if I asked you all to close them and then write on a piece of paper, what did you just sing about? Would you be able to answer? If you're unable to answer, you've taken the name of God in vain. But if you're able to answer, you have honored his name, you have revered his name, you have worshipped his name. What about prayer? If somebody listened to our prayers, would they say, that name to that person is wonderful? That name obviously puts awe into that person. Or would they hear our prayers and say, well, he just uses that name, she just uses that name as if it's Tom, Dick, or Harry? It's using God's name almost like a comma. Thoughtlessly, carelessly, repetitively. You should ask people who listen to you pray from time to time, am I using God's name rightly in prayer? Am I using it too often as like a breath or taking a breath? Am I using the same name all the time, just in an unthinking, empty way? If so, you know, there are hundreds of names for God in the Bible that we can learn. It's wonderful, 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 a wonderful name. When you hear somebody's name, it creates a response in your heart, doesn't it? Say any name. Barack Obama. Every one of you had a response to that, that you could sum up in one word. Ben Carson. You pick a name from politics, pick a name from business, pick a name from sport, pick a name from your family, pick a name from church. Go around, just think of a name. There's a word that comes to mind, isn't there? A predominant impression. You might hear this name, you think, sad. You hear another name, you think, happy. You hear another name, you think, bit greedy. You hear another name, you think, not trustworthy. You hear another name, you think, always negative. Another name, a bit too optimistic. And so it goes on. Because we associate the name with character, don't we? And this is when we hear the name of God, we hear Lord or Jesus or Christ or Savior or Redeemer or whatever name we hear, here's what should happen. One word. Wonder. 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 It's a wonderful name. But moving on briefly, we have a wonderful act here. A wonderful act. Manoah stops conversing and starts getting the sacrifice together. Verse 19, takes a kid with meat offering, offers it on a rock to the Lord. And you, again, you remember, this is the Son of God that's watching here. What's happening? The Son of God is watching Manoah. He gets the lamb. He brings it. He kills it. He slits it. He bleeds it. He cuts it in pieces. He puts it on the rock. A fire comes down or a fire comes up. We're not told what, but a fire appears. It's burned. It goes up in flames. Remember who's watching this. The pre-incarnate Son. This was the closest he had ever come to sacrifice before he did his own sacrificing in human flesh. Here, as he watches the lamb being chosen, he's thinking of his own being selected for sacrifice. He's anticipating. He knows the meaning of the Old Testament sacrifices. He knows that they point towards him and his work. He sees that lamb bleating. He hears the cries and thinks of his own. He sees the cut and the blood and the death and thinks of his own. He sees the flame and thinks of the wrath of God. He sees the sacrifice going up. He smells it. He feels it, the heat of it. And what does he do? Does he run away and think, I don't want to think about that. I want to put that out of my mind, that horror that lies ahead. No, look what he does. He jumps into the flame. We're told at the end of verse 18, as the sacrifice is offered, the angel did wondrously, this wonderful person, did a wonderful act as Manoah and his wife looked on. Why? Because it came to pass when the flame went up toward heaven from off the altar that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. Here, as he sees this sacrifice, he doesn't run from it, he runs to it. He's saying, this is what I'm all about. This is what I want to do. And it's almost like a rehearsal. It's like a trial run, like a practice. Not in human flesh, as we've said, but in human form. Not in pain, as it would be, but here, getting a sense of what lay ahead. He climbs onto the stone. He steps into the flame, and up he goes. Ascending to God as part of this sweet-smelling sacrifice. It's remarkable. No wonder it says the angel did wondrously. Does an extraordinary thing here. It's like the old people in the Highlands of Scotland used to say, he's trying on the clothes of his incarnation. And notice the reaction. That's our last point, a wonderful fellowship. Because what do Manoah and his wife do? End of verse 20, they fall on their faces to the ground. The angels disappeared. We're told in verse 21, Manoah knew that he was an angel of the Lord. Try and picture that scene. What's just happened? He's gone. They're lying on the ground, face to face maybe. This conclusion has arrived at, this was no man. Next words, we're dead. We're dead. Manoah turns to his wife and says, we shall surely die because we have seen God. He knew his theology, this man. That's what Moses had taught him earlier on in the book of Exodus. No man can see God and live. Manoah says, we've seen God. We're dead. It's over. We're finished. And it's here you see a beautiful fellowship between this man and his wife, because his wife says, no. No, Manoah, you've got this wrong. If the Lord wanted to kill us, if he were pleased to kill us, he wouldn't have received a burnt offering. He wouldn't have showed us all these things. He wouldn't have told us such things as these. Do you see how she's reasoning? He like looks at what he's seen and felt, and he comes to a conclusion based on these feelings. And his conclusion is, it's over. We're doomed. We're dead. We're finished. So he says, no. Let's get back to theology here. Look, would he kill us after having accepted our sacrifice, shown us such amazing revelations, and spoken such gracious words to us? It's a beautiful husband-wife, wife-husband counseling session here. They're in the dust. He's trembling. She's confident. She knows the truth. And she's saying, come on, Manoah, let's look at the facts. Let's reason ourselves to a better conclusion. It's interesting, isn't it? Two believers, they see exactly the same things, and they draw totally different conclusions. One's dead, one thinks, this is wonderful. And it shows us how much we need one another, doesn't it? To get to good conclusions. One to pick another up. One to help another along. To reason on the basis of truth and scripture. What a beautiful fellowship they had in the dust there as they pondered the person and the work of the Son of God. What peace was transmitted to them, to her, and then from her to him. It's a wonderful fellowship, Christ-centered, gospel-centered, truth-centered fellowship. Manoah was right in this sense, no mediator. We're dead. We're dead. If you don't have Christ as your mediator, you're dead. You do have no hope. You have no hope of your sacrifice being accepted, no matter how much you do or give. But if you have Christ as your mediator, as your sacrifice, that you offer to God daily and say, that's all my hope, you're alive forevermore. Isn't that wonderful? You can have wonderful fellowship with God through the person and work of Jesus Christ, and that alone. Wonderful fellowship. How much more wonderful was that name to them after this? May it be to us after this as well. Let's pray.